Anyway, the talk for this evening, because somebody asked me about this a few days ago, and I'm sure I've talked about it before. It'll always be slightly different. And it's a very simple subject, because you know, when I give talks, that I don't plan anything. All I plan to do is make myself nice and peaceful before I give a talk and see what comes out. So there's nothing in here which I write down or think about, or this is what I'm going to say, this is how I'm going to say, just let it come. So a nice simple talk for this evening, what people asked me last week sometime, is the meaning of life. Very simple subject. Because it's a subject which I'm sure people have written books and PhDs and all sorts of other nonsense about. And I know years ago, which I said, I remember Ajahn Saruna reminded me of this some weeks ago. He said that, I told him, he said, the meaning of life is the meaning you give your life. We said, that's a good start. What do you give your, what meaning do you give your life and your journey? But even that is a bit of an approximation. It's a meaning you give your life today, because that meaning, that purpose, will always be changing. And even that, you know, we can refine that even more. Because sometimes when we look at the meaning of your life, well, first of all, other people give us the meaning of life. They tell us what to do and where we should be looking. And I'm not sure about you, but I was always rebellious, always, you know, good in the sense of, you know, just not being destructive and respecting people like my parents and teachers, and, but always questioning and saying, really, is that qualifies a true meaning of life? And of course, like many of you, you start off thinking the meaning of your life, your purpose, is to pass your exams and be clever, be smart. And if you've got your kids doing exams this week or this year, take them out of this hall right now, because they shouldn't listen to a monk like me. I worked really hard doing my exams and I did very well. Fat lot of good that did me. It's true. I got really good results in, you know, one of the toughest subjects, theoretical physics, at Cambridge University. But there was always something during that career in science. That's really hard science. There was something which was always challenging. Is this really what you should be doing in life? Well, finding the astrophysics of the galaxy, or the meaning of like dark matter, or just even little things like what matter is made of. I thought that would be really interesting, until after a little while you figured out that no one knew. They had theories, sorts of ideas, but it was, this matter was always moving around, always changing its shape, combining with other stuff, coming and going. So what actually really was it? Because with the meaning of like stuff, something which is right here, the word, what actually is it? And it's not the stuff which was important, I figured out. It's actually the forces between the stuff, how it interacts together. It was almost like those forces and interactions that actually really define what stuff truly is. The stuff is not independent of other stuff. But also, because I had a sense of humor. Sometimes people say a bad sense of humor, but it's a sense of humor. Sometimes I used to love playing around with the words of the English language. And one of those, because I remember in the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, which was very famous, you are taken to the room where J.J. Thompson discovered the electron. There are other places where people discovered lasers. And you're always very careful to make sure that all the experimenters, all the lasers turned off in case you got zapped. One of the movies which I did see before I became a monk, if anyone my age, the James Bond movie, where was it, Mr. Goldfinger? I think almost sort of cut James Bond in half with a laser beam. That's my memory of lasers. So going around Cavendish Laboratory where all these old professors, crazy old bearded professors were playing around with laser beams was pretty scary. But I also remember going to the room where the great Kiwi professor Rutherford, where he split the atom. The idea of the atom being the fundamental, I mean really fundamental, particle which made up stuff. We all know better now, but this is where people started, an atom. In fact, the Greek word actually means indivisible, cannot be split up. And that's why these great philosophers use that, the indivisible part of stuff. And of course, the great Kiwi split it in two and found out it was not indivisible or fundamental at all. And as soon as they get into the deeper stuff, that too can be split up. And everything can be split up. Nothing is really stable except the forces which keep these things dancing around each other. But that's just stuff. I always thought, what about the thing which knows all this stuff and experiences it, the mind, your conscious awareness? What about that? And you know what that is called? In Eastern philosophy, that was called the Atma. In Buddhism, we call it the Atta. It's a Pali derivative of the Sanskrit, but the Atma. And then something kind of coincided. Atma, atom. Is there some connection there? And of course, you bet there is. The sense of self, the indivisible nature of the human being, the core, your soul, that too is divisible. It comes and it goes. That too is not the essence of you. That was split much earlier than Rutherford. That was split by this fellow called the Buddha in India under the Bodhi tree, realizing that that too has got no fundamental, indivisible substance. But instead of stuff, we have the relationships between stuff. That is a fundamental part of life. So the meaning of life, first of all, it's not everything you've attained in life. All of those achievements which you have, all of those certificates, all of those records you've broken, all of those personal bests you've achieved, all of the stuff you've amassed in your life. I know that people amass so much. I found that out as a monk. Please don't ever do this to me again. But this gentleman, a very, very nice member of our Buddhist society, you know, he made me the executor of his will. And I found that out. The first time I really found that out, he must have asked me, but I probably said, oh yes, and just was not really paying too much attention. But the first time I found that out was when a policeman came to see me at Bodhinyana Monastery. And I said, what do you want to see me for? He said, I've just got to inform you that, you know, Mr. Creek has passed away. Really? Why do you want to tell me? He said, because according to his will, I was the executor, so I had to be told. And so we had to go through the procedure of going through all of his personal belongings. He only had a small house, as that's a small flat, but the amount of stuff which he had in that house was huge. And it took, I couldn't get rid of it all. They were talking to people like dear old President Dennis was there with the vans and getting rid of stuff. And it was really a lot of hard work. It took had about a week or two to get rid of. And all this stuff he'd accumulated over the years. So please, please, don't make me the executor of your will. I don't have time to clean up other people's houses. But it's all worked well because the house itself was actually over in Scarborough. It was actually right next to the ocean. And so I think we sold it, or rather, good old Eddie, where is he? I saw he was here earlier. Eddie, around the back there, sold it for us. Yeah, thank you, Eddie. And that actually paid off a lot of the debts for the nuns' monastery, I think. So that was really very helpful. It was worthwhile cleaning up for that. Well, you've got to get donations somewhere. But the meaning of life is not all those things which you accumulate in this world. It's just more stuff. And next, of course, you know, a lot of times there's a few friends who still remember him, but how many other people really remember him? And as for you, this was actually scared me when I was young. I thought, you know, maybe 100 years, who would remember me? Maybe because I'm a well-known monk now, maybe a few of my books they might remember. But then, or later on, maybe, I don't know, when I die, you might make a little statue of me here in Dhammaloka. But please, if you do make a statue of me, please make a statue of me when I was young and handsome, not the fat old monk. Otherwise, all these people will be coming close to me and just rubbing my tummy for good luck all the time. Now, someone actually did that once. It's a Chinese tradition. It was just close to Chinese New Year. Honestly, this happened. I was just standing close to the reception area, just talking to somebody, and this Chinese woman came up and just looked at me, and a big smile on her face, caught her hand and started rubbing my belly. I couldn't stop her. Anyway, she was very happy anyway, so that's my life. But after a while, there's nothing will remain of you. What was your meaning? So stuff can't be the meaning, but the relationship we have with stuff, the relationship you have with one another, the relationship you have with your life, that will be where meaning lies. When things go well in your life, how do you relate to that? How does that affect you? What are those forces between you and success, or you and loss, or you or things coming and going? That is much more where we find the meaning of our life, how we deal with tragedies in life. And I'm saying this story because this comes up so often. Came up when I was over in Thailand teaching a retreat. I was teaching a retreat over in Thailand, and even though it was in Thailand, you know, there's not that many people had coronavirus. I think we had 20, 30, 40 or something in the whole country when I was there. But still, the people there, they insisted on taking everybody's temperature as we walked into the meditation room, including me. So I had to have my temperature taken. You know what I found out? And I checked this. All the other people who were with me, I checked in their readings and my readings. My readings were the lowest. And it proved to me something, that I am a very cool monk. 35 point something. But anyhow, the meaning of life is your relation to these things. Are you afraid of the virus? Are you at peace with things which happen to you when it doesn't go your way? And especially, you know, the problem when loved ones pass away, the death. I'm going to just stop on that point for a few moments, because this is one of those teachings I've found totally effective. It is when somebody passes away. My father died only 16. You've heard it so many times before, but here it comes again. What's your relationship with hearing this story again? As I think I said to the people in Thailand, I've heard this story more times than anyone. Because I keep telling it. But anyway, when he died, I never felt sad, even though I love my father very much. Why? And it was because of the symphony of the concert. I grew up in London. And in London, there was just so many opportunities to listen to great music. I just saw, I do look on the internet, on ABC News and BBC News websites, and I found out that just one of my heroes, there was an article about him, Pete Green of Fleetwood Mac, and he started off with John Mayall's Blues Breakers. That was, I saw him a couple of times perform. That was in the 60s. And all those people I went to see, I just enjoyed their music so much. And I've told you all these other people have seen, Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix, and even some of the great jazz musicians, which I saw and enjoyed, and saw so many of those performing. And that at the end of the concert, when it was finished, and I walked out, because everyone had to walk out, never once did I feel sad at the ending of a concert, at the ending of a great performance. I always felt privileged, blessed, so lucky to have been there and listened to some of the greatest musicians. This was London in the 60s. And that was the same feeling when my father died. What a great performance that was. How can anyone feel sad when you notice what a great performance that had been? You felt like just standing up, giving him another round of applause, cheering him. Well done, tremendous, thank you. It was only 16 years, short performance, but still terrific. That was how I looked. That was my relationship. That was the meaning which I gave to losing someone very important to me. Beautiful, wonderful. I don't know but where that attitude came from. But you could always see the positive meaning in anything. Next Friday I will not be here, because I'm going over to Indonesia to give some talks. And I'll be leaving actually just on Sunday afternoon, which is why I've asked Ven Wasunio to do the Sutta class. And it's wonderful. And over here in Perth, it's not just the Ajahn Brahm show. Ajahn Bamali, he's over in Malaysia right now teaching. And there's Venerable Hasapanya. And all these other monks and nuns come over here to give great talks. And during the rains retreat, we get other people coming up here. It's not a person, it's not a cult. This is actually learning how to teach and having the relationship with those teachers. So yeah, it's tough the first time you give a talk. If you have the right attitude, you learn so much. It's not whether it's a good talk or a bad talk. It's just a talk. Remember, one of those monks, Ajahn Chah, asked him to give a talk one evening in the main hall for 1 hour in Thai. A Westerner, it was actually Ajahn Sumedho, if any of you remember him, he told me this story. He had to give a talk in Thai for 1 hour in front of his teacher, Ajahn Chah, which is tough. But he did it and got through it. So after the talk was finished, he was about to just get off in front of the microphone and just bow, but then Ajahn Chah said, another hour. 2 hours. And just so he's repeating himself and just lots of pauses. But you know, his teacher asked him, so he had to. And of course, quite a few people had left by now. But you know, it's not about ego, it's just about just, you know, doing just, you know, what Ajahn Chah thinks is going to be learning something. So he finished his second hour, and Ajahn Chah said, another hour. 3 hours. You know, even just if you lived in Thailand, after just, you know, 3 hours, you know, you don't know what the heck you're going to talk about. And there's all sorts of, and everyone gets so bored. There's only Ajahn Chah, a couple of monks, and most of the people are gone. And, you know, there's a few sort of those wall geckos listening to you. Other than that, everyone else there is half asleep or fully asleep. But he finished the 3 hours. Whoa, that was just so tough. And Ajahn Chah said, another hour. And this poor monk had to give 4 hours of talk, didn't know what he was talking about, just rubbish. And everybody had left except Ajahn Chah. And he said, from that day on, every other talk he ever gave was far better than that. So he never felt sad. That was what Ajahn Chah was teaching him. It doesn't matter, you try your very best, but 4 hours, even Ajahn Chah would probably give a boring talk. But what the point was that, you know, that you are your relationship to what you're doing. You're not getting upset or angry. You're seeing some positive part in it. And that sort of positive part in whatever you're doing in this life, you get tired sometimes. Oh, I feel so tired. But there is a meaning in that. This is what I learned as a young monk. Even things you never thought had meaning did have some incredible meanings. To the point that even mosquitoes, Ajahn Chah, when I complained about the mosquitoes, look, there is a thing called mosquito repellent, Ajahn Chah. You know, there's plenty of lay people over here. I'm sure that this was years ago in Thailand. I'm sure they will offer some mosquito repellent for the monks so we can sit down there and meditate and get nice meditation instead of having all these mosquitoes all over you. And he said, no. He said, from today on, Brahma Wang, so that's me, you will now call the mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito. For the Thais, Ajahn Yung. So we had to call, you know, so this is crazy stuff. What do you learn from mosquitoes? I learned how to meditate from mosquitoes. They're brilliant teachers. Because I've told this story to many people before. This is what I learned, because there's no mosquito repellent. And you sat there, we'd have to meditate that first year with Ajahn Chah, 2 hour sessions out in the forest. Mosquitoes were all over you at first. But then you learn how to meditate, thanks to Ajahn Mosquito. Because you had a choice. It was a choice. You could actually just, my hand is being eaten by a mosquito, my shoulders, there won't be any shoulder left after 2 hours that have drunk all the blood. And sometimes I would imagine, I'm sure it's just imagination, but you know, sometimes you think, what's the difference between imagination and reality? Sometimes you could hear, was that the mosquito sucking all the blood from your... There's about 60 or 70 on there at the time. That's a lot. But I had a choice. And my choice was, are you going to meditate or are you going to just start worrying? What is your relationship? What meaning are you giving to being consumed alive by mosquitoes? So I remember what Ajahn Chah said. Call it Ajahn Mosquito. They're teaching you something. What they taught me was so sort of similar to the old Zen monks with the stick. You know, you've seen those on the movies or on the documentaries in the Zen temples. When you're meditating, they walk behind you, and if you move, if you go to sleep, whack! People told me it didn't hurt. I didn't believe them. Sounded like it hurt to me. I only once went to one of those retreats for a weekend retreat when I was in 21 or 22 or something. And we had to sit up there in the morning time. And you didn't sleep very much, you know, just a new place and somebody snoring. There's always somebody snoring on these retreats. Because I suffered on those retreats when I was young, that's why when we built Jhana Grove Retreat, what we have over here, it's just so comfortable. You have your own room. And I had to sleep with other people in the room, always snoring and making noises or coughing. So you didn't get much sleep. And in the morning you had to meditate. And your head went down, sleepy. Fortunately, and I must have had some very good karma in my past life, because it was the monk sitting next to me was more asleep than I was. He got hit first. And as soon as he got hit, that was it. That totally got rid of my sloth and torpor. And I wasn't sleeping at all, I was fully awake and terrified. Oh, well, you know, I can't miss this story about when I was in Hong Kong a couple of years ago, that just talking with one of the monks from mainland China, and said they tried that in one of the retreats in the mainland, the Zen retreat. And this monk came along with the Zen stick, and it was this middle-aged woman. She was falling asleep when she was meditating. And so the Zen monk, the master, hit her on the back with the Zen stick. You know what she did? Got out her cell phone and called the police. It's an offense to hit people. And the police took the monk away, arrested him. That was the end of that retreat. That was a true story. So we don't But anyway, those mosquitoes, sort of in Thailand, the Thai mosquitoes, that what they taught me is, okay, you meditate, you can't mess around. I really have to relax. Because I knew what would happen. If, you know, when you sit down, they don't come onto you straight away. They wait a while until all your defenses are down. And then they attack in mass. So I knew I didn't have much time. So I knew I had to close my eyes and just really meditate. Really let go. Present moment awareness. Exactly as I taught, you know, at the beginning of this session this evening. Just relax my body. Just relax my mind. Just eventually get to my breath and just become so peaceful. Until all you got is your breath, and even the breath starts to disappear. And then the nice thing was, you couldn't feel your body. The body vanished. It's one of the things which happens in meditation. As you go deep inside, you can't feel your hands, and you can't feel your shoulders, you can't feel your head, you can't feel anything. Because that part of you just disappears as you go inside into the mind. And that was a wonderful thing to experience, because that meant, I thought, this is what I thought, mosquitoes can do whatever they want, because I can't feel them. You didn't. So a couple of hours meditating, nice and peaceful, and you came out afterwards. The weird thing was, I couldn't see any mosquito bites on my arm, on my head. It was actually free. And that's when I thought, wow, psychic powers. In deep meditation, you have like a force field around you. That's what I thought, the force field of deep meditation. That's why the mosquitoes, they couldn't get in there. And it was only years later, over here in Australia, just again looking through those news sites, you found out that mosquitoes, they are attracted mostly to carbon dioxide coming out of your pores of your skin. So the more you're metabolizing, the more active you are, the more the mosquitoes can find you. So especially those people who are really, really worried about mosquitoes, your metabolism goes up and you're actually saying to them, hey mosquitoes, I'm very worried about you, but I'm over here, come over here I am. But when you're very calm and very still and peaceful, they can't even find you. You vanish from mosquito land. And it's so nice. So that's Ajahn Chah correct again. I found so much meaning by learning how not to worry about things and about the power of peace and stillness. People find a lot of worry in this life. People are so afraid. They're scared of life to the point that so many people don't even go out into the world. I was talking to some, she's probably listening, and she is the carer of this nice little fluffy little thing called Suzu, was scared to go out in Hong Kong. Yeah, there's coronavirus. Yeah, there used to be, you know, people just protesting and lots of what's that gas, whatever it is, anyway. But people were so scared. But what is your relationship to all of that? Is fear, being scared, the right way of relating to things? Because you find that most people who are scared, they're the ones who, because of their tightness of their body, their immune system gets very weak and actually get these things. So anyway, that when I am in the next place I'm going to, I mentioned earlier, is to Indonesia. I told a few people earlier that the last place which I'm going to before I come back here to Perth is teaching a meditation retreat in Bali. And I just went, you know, on the internet, because they gave me the name of the hotel, you know, hiring a whole hotel to actually do the meditation retreat. It's a beautiful hotel, you know, not far from the beach. I'm only there for 2 or 3 days. What a waste of an opportunity. So my plan is see if I can get coronavirus on those last days, and then I'll have to do 2-week quarantine in a beautiful hotel in Bali next to the beach. Would that be a good idea? That's how Ajahn Brahm thinks. It will never happen, obviously. But when you're afraid of something happens, that fear, that relationship is never going to be positive. Fear, those negative emotions, take away the real meaning of life, which is to engage, to be in life, even maybe to challenge yourself. If it's too much, you can always draw back. But never be afraid. Even when, see, just going back, because I mentioned it earlier, so the science which I did over in the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, he saw so much positivity there. If you know, you wanted to do an experiment, you know, you go to see your tutor or your supervisor and say, yeah, give it a try. Who knows what might happen? Most of those experiments were absolutely stupid. They didn't get anywhere. They wasted money, blew up equipment or whatever. But they would never say no. Because they told me afterwards, out of like 1,000 stupid experiments, one would actually work, would change the world. That's why it was always positive. Always give it a try. See what happens. See what we can learn from this. And that was why, what I learned at a place like that. The meaning of your life, how are you relating to all this stuff which occurs to you? It's never going to be the way you expect it. It is out of control. In fact, that was one saying which I had, which is, don't worry, it's out of control anyway. Haven't you figured that out by now? What did you expect would happen this year? Has it happened? You are faced every day with things you don't expect. And when they happen, instead of getting angry, it shouldn't be this way. The weather said today, and I looked at it on the news this morning, 60% chance of rain. There was no rain. No rain at all down in Serpentine Monastery, unless it rained this afternoon when I left. But all the things which you anticipate and plan for, how many of them actually happen in life? How many of you thought, say, even 2 years ago, you'd be sitting here listening to me on a Friday night? Sometimes, somebody's laughing their head off over there. Sometimes, you know, we have to learn how to accept that life is out of control. We can sort of nudge it this way, nudge it that way. But really, when life surprises us, what do you do? This is actually how we find meaning in life. Realizing that we don't have too many plans. Have a few plans, but always be ready to change. That's why any plan should never be built out of concrete. If you have plans, build them out of rubber so you can bend them or just, you know, untie them, snip them, copy and paste, try another way of doing the same plans in a different way. Because that means you can innovate and change and find out just how you can use all of the different things which life gives to you and make something wonderful out of it. In other words, what I'm talking about, the relationships and how you do things, is making sure that we don't have what in Buddhism is called like the poisons of greed, hatred and delusion, and learning how to make good karma in life. In other words, what Ajahn Gunhai used to say, service. Because I went to go and see him recently, and he kept on saying the same old thing, service, service, service. The meaning of life. What does that actually mean? Because when you're served, what actually are you serving? Are you serving your partner? Serving your boss? Are you serving the committee members sitting here? Are you serving the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia? That's me, by the way. I'm not up for election at the AGM. That is for life. But I could always get kicked out. Actually, I tried to get kicked out last year. I resigned. No, it wasn't last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I resigned. But then I had to give it to Ayahasapanya, who made sure that she resigned, so it gave it back to me afterwards. Anyway, I tried my best. It was a good plan. But you see, the way we relate to things, that's where the meaning is, and the way we serve. But trouble is that people just, I don't know why they do this. Some people serve others, serve until they get burnt out. That is where that meaning of life, and this is, as a monk, I do have these opportunities, these rare opportunities to actually to influence people, and it's not just giving talks on a Friday night. That wonderful occasion when people get married, and I have the opportunity of looking at them in the eye. You know that when people get married, they really do listen to what I say, much more than even you do right now. They're really full attention. And I love that time when I work this one out. And you can imagine just two people getting married, all dressed up and all their friends and relations there and just all that sort of stuff. And just, you know, Dennis has just exchanged the rings, and we always have this same old story. Dennis actually does the formal marriage, because as a monk I'm not allowed to do that. And my job is to try and keep them together. He does a marriage, and you know, I just try and... Well, I was saying, people, it's in the car coming up here today. That's one of my stories. Because we're talking about, you know, those books which I write. There's one of my books, this story is in... But, you know, it was one of the main reasons why the book was not translated. It was actually translated to Hebrew, but it couldn't get it published. You understand the reason why it couldn't be published in Israel. That was the story of when people actually meet together, and, you know, sometimes they get married, sometimes they just live together. Sometimes they're involved, and sometimes they're committed. And to make it very clear what the difference is, the difference between being involved and being committed in a relationship is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, think about it. Come on, use your intelligence. In bacon and eggs, the chicken is only involved. The pig is committed. And that story was one of the reasons I could not publish that book in Israel. Because of, you know, pigs and pork and stuff. Anyway. But with looking at the bride, looking her right in the eyes. I'm old enough to do that now. I don't get any misunderstandings, look her right in the eyes and say, you are now a married woman. From this day on, you must not think of yourself. And she always just agrees. And then I look at the groom, the guy. Same thing. Got to be fair. Equity. I look at him and said, "You are now a married man. From this day on, you must not think of yourself." He always pauses. Always pauses. That's true. This is anecdotal. I've done this many times. He always waits for and thinks it over. Then eventually he goes, "Okay." And the guys are laughing, and some of the girls are too, because you know this is absolutely true. And then I look at looking at the guy and say, "From this day on, you're a married man. You must not think of her, your wife." And this is the amazing part of this little anecdote, because you don't need to be a meditator to read his mind. He's thinking, who have we got to bless our marriage? What's this crazy monk doing here? And then I turn to her and say, "From this moment on, you must not think of him, your husband." And have this wonderful, you don't rush this, you have this wonderful moment of like confusion. Now confusion is really great, because when people get confused, they're trying to work out what this means. Their mind is actually free and open, because they're not quite sure where this is going. They're not saying, "Oh yeah, I know what's coming next." They're actually listening. So a lot of times we find meaning in confusing times. We don't know why, what's going on. That means our mind is just really sort of open to learning. And of course the answer is, from this moment on, you must not think of your partner, you must not think of yourself, you must only think of us. And they get it. Ah, yeah. And many of you have heard the story before, or you have been married before, or you're married right now. You notice this is the problem here. If it's about him or her or me or this or that, it just gets very difficult. It's about us. Our Buddhist Society Committee. It's not about the president or the spiritual director or the vice president or the treasurer. It's about us. We're in it together. We're a team. And every Buddhist Society of West Australia, all the other people who come here, you know that sometimes this is a Thai temple, a Sri Lankan temple, an Australian temple, a Vietnamese temple, a Cambodian temple, a Ukrainian temple. I don't know what, all the other, Laotian temple. Have I left anyone else out? Australia, yeah, I did mention Australia, whatever. But anyway, all the people come from so many different places. You're all welcome. Why? Because it's about us. When we change the relationship, it's not about me, it's not about them, it's about us, and we're serving us. It's about all of us. And that gives life a great meaning. So I can give and serve. There are times when I say, enough, I'm going to the toilet. I've got to serve my bladder. Oh, I don't know how many times that's happened. I don't know why people look at monks and probably nuns as well. You think that somehow or other we don't have to go to the toilet. You know, I mean, somehow monks have trained themselves, or I don't know what, use psychic powers or whatever. Oh, what was that time? Please excuse me for going on. But that time, it was in Hong Kong, in one of the big places that had all these riots recently or protests. And just after giving a talk, you know, you go there and you meet all the dignitaries and you give a talk for an hour, then questions and answers. It takes about 2 hours to finish a talk. And then after the talk is finished, all these people coming up, signing books and just asking questions. It took another hour to get to the toilet. And by the time I got to the toilet, it was the Jockey Club auditorium in one of the universities, I forget. It was one of these big toilets, the male toilets. And as soon as I got in, it just says, yes, I can actually go to the toilet now. And as soon as I walked in the door, this guy was just washing his hands, and he turned to me and said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you a question on meditation?" Within the toilet. It was a good anecdote for people. Anyway, just I survived somehow or other. But you've got to look after yourself, look after others. When you find that balance, then your life does have meaning. Balancing, kindness, wisdom, real service is a combination of kindness and wisdom. It's not just kindness. Sometimes people are so kind. And that story of the Boy Scout, his one good deed of the day, he helped an old lady cross a busy road. The problem was, she didn't want to go. And that is a symbol of much of life. Come on, I'll take you across the road. I don't want to go. No, come on, I've got to do my good deed. Oh, thank you. So when we have wisdom and kindness, when those two come together, they're powerful. And when those two come together, we know what service is. The relationship we have to all the different things which we are part of in life. Just like whether you're a quark, subatomic particle, or a proton or a positron, how they interrelate with all the different things of life. They're in it together. And then they find meaning in life, kindness and wisdom. Not control, but caring and understanding. That is the meaning of life. Da da da. Okay, very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, you know what sadhu means? Awesome, yes, it means awesome. That's my translation of the day. Okay, so now we have some questions from overseas, maybe, or maybe some from in here. Let's see what we've got today. It's so exciting. Okay, from USA, no, I don't like that one. Russia, no, London, no. Okay, here we go. From USA, when the personal meaning of kindness and good intention results in harm to both myself or others, how do we overcome doubt and our faith in kindness? Is remorse or forgiveness more appropriate for myself? Yeah, of course. Your personal meaning of kindness, but it has to have the understanding and wisdom as well. And it's not just kindness to others, it's kindness to yourself as well. You're in it together. It's kindness to us. That's why this one comes from the USA, which means us, America. Okay, I'll try. And if it results in harm to yourself, if it's just minor harm, like a doctor doing surgery, that harms you, but it's got good results afterwards. Maybe that's okay. But also use the wisdom and understanding. Personal meaning of kindness. What actually is kindness? Kindness is that which does not harm others, which actually creates good for other people, which creates peace and harmony for us. It's like caring. Even like kindness, sometimes say that word. I prefer caring, that word, because caring, it also has this other meaning like being careful. See what you're doing and make sure it doesn't cause damage to other people or to you. However, if it has, then learn from it. In life, you are allowed to make mistakes. I make mistakes. I've told many of you about my mistakes or the stupid things which I've done. But you learn from mistakes. That's what mistakes are there for, to learn. You make a mistake. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. So don't hit yourself and feel you're terrible, you're stupid, you're something wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. It's just that's how we learn. Just like when you're sick, remember you should never go and see your GP and say, there's something wrong with me, I'm sick. You always say, there's something right with me, I'm sick. It's okay to be sick. There's nothing wrong with being sick. And because everyone is sick from time to time. And so, remorse or forgiveness? Remorse is, don't just think, oh, I'm a terrible person, I need to be punished or something like that. No, learn. what happened, why. So you're growing from the mistakes of life. From Russia, thanks for the Art of Disappearing book. Yes, one of the best. But I have to thank Ajahn Brahmada because he did the translation for that. He translated it from Ajahn Brahm into English. Now he was the one who just got them all together and edited it. I finally understood what meditation is about. Excellent. But it seems I became reluctant to do things and duties. How may I find the balance? By doing loving-kindness meditation. Because loving-kindness meditation is just beautiful. May all beings be happy and well. Not just me, but all beings. It's a loving-kindness meditation which actually engages you with other people in the world. Where you realize your service to others. I know that even Ajahn Chah used to do that. Whenever any monk just got really deep meditation, he'd take him upstairs and he'd talk to him, and we find out eventually what he said, now you've got to really do a lot of loving kindness so you serve other people in the world. That's really important. Otherwise you become what's called, you know, this, like the Pacheka Buddha, like the silent one. Great wisdom, great kindness, great sort of possibilities, but you just don't give. Loving kindness just takes you out and just gives so much to the world. So, from Russia, please do lots of loving kindness, and then you just engage with the world without losing your peace. Lastly, Martin in London, how can we make the right decisions easily in the modern world when there are so many options? For example, right partner, right career. Well, that's so simple, making decisions. You know, I have to make many decisions every day. Should I brush my teeth in this side or that side over there or in the middle? Or do it in the middle of it. I'll do the rat first of all. Do you always brush your teeth starting on the same place? Or do you actually, I call this living on the wild side. Start brushing your teeth a different place every time. Don't become a creature of habit. So they make decision. You find that it doesn't really matter what part you start brushing your teeth, as long as you brush your teeth and do all the parts, you know, before you finish. Same with life. Choosing the right partner. What was it? Somebody asked me this question when I was teaching in Oslo many years ago. I'd never forget this because, again, silly Ajahn Brahm making a mistake. This woman questioned time and said, if I have a really important decision to make in my life, how do I make it? And so, this is my mistake. I said, well, suppose, you know, the decision was, should I get married to the guy sitting next to me? And I shouldn't have done that, because she went red, bright red. That was the decision she was making. I got it straight away. And so I said, look, if that is your decision, which is, you know, it's reasonably important, people think. I added that, people think. And I said, look, if you have such an important decision to make in your eyes, get out a coin, toss it. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. I think you all know where this is leading because you've probably heard it before, read it in the book. Heads I marry him, tails I don't. Now, it comes up, tails, I don't. What's the reaction? How do you feel? It's come up tails. Do inside, do you think, yes? Or do you think, let's try 2 out of 3? It's the reaction. Remember, the reaction is the meaning of life. Not in the events, but how you relate to them. If you react, 2 out of 3, I want to try this again. That means you want to marry him, so marry him. And if it comes up, yes, that means you don't. All that tossing a coin up is not to make the decision, but to reveal how you feel. You know, your intuition, if you like, your inner understanding of where you want to go in life. That is more important. And anyway, if that doesn't work, you know, you can always get divorced, try again, learn again. It's not the end of the world, but whatever, you'll find that sometimes that life is amazing. Sometimes you give somebody a chance and they turn out to be an amazing person, much better than you ever expected. And if they're not as good as you expect, well, look at yourself in a mirror. You're not as good as he expects either. So you're a match. So in other words, whatever you do in life, you turn left. You know, when you go out of this room, if you, I don't know where you've got your car, if maybe a long way, you turn left when you can't go out of this room. You go right as you go out of this room. They all go around the Buddha and they meet at the only exit we've got over there. So it all comes round to the same exit. So after a while, you're making a decision. It doesn't really matter. What does matter, though, is that relationship you have to decision-making. Are you scared of making decisions? Now that is a problem. Just make the decision. Turn left, turn right, I'm going to make the decision. And next, the second part is, when you make that decision, the most important time is after you've made the decision. Save all of your energy till after you've made the decision to make sure that decision is right. It's not right because you decided the right way. It's because you put the energy into that decision once you made it. Make it work. And if you do that, you find it very successful in life. So it's what you do after you made the decision. That is where the energy belongs. Okay. So, any questions from... I usually say from the floor, but it really should be from the cushions or from the chairs. Or other people sitting in those things. Going. Going. Gone. Okay. So... no questions. You are allowed to come and ask a few personal questions afterwards because I don't need to go to the toilet that quickly this evening. I went beforehand. And thank you all for coming. I'm going to pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivadami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sango Sangang Namami.